All right, welcome to session number 371, the Sunstone Debate, Is Religion Valuable? This, although Sunstone has been having rigorous discussions and debates before, this is an actual, this is a debate. So this is also an experiment, and so we want your feedback. And this is something that people have been talking about for years, and these two have not done this. And so I'm really excited that Jared and John have decided to debate. I mean, people have been asking for this for years. So I'm really excited and very grateful that they allowed Sunstone to be the venue to do this. And I'm going to introduce them, and then I'm going to turn it over to the debate moderator, because luckily I don't have to moderate. But I will be helping out with the question and answers. We're going to do the question and answers a little bit differently this time. Since we are short on mics, if you have a question for these guys in the course of the debate, on this white table up here are paper and pencils. We'd ask you to write your question down and your name, and then come put it up here quietly on the table, and then it will be filtered in sort of order of relevance, I guess, and as we have time. So if you have a question for the debate, instead of a traditional Q&A after, you can write your questions down anytime through the debate. Okay, so I'm excited to introduce our amazing, not panelists, debaters?
Our master debaters.
I didn't want to say that. I guess time will tell, right? Okay, but first I want to introduce the debate moderator. He is a pro. This is Blake Marsh, and he's the assistant debate coach at Weber State University. He has experience of 10 years experience in competitive debates. He also has a bachelor's of training and development at Weber State, and so we're really lucky to have him here handling this. So I don't have to just get up and say, guys, stop fighting. Because I love these guys, I love them both. And let me introduce Jared Anderson. I'm sure you guys all know all these people, but I'm going to read their bios. So Jared Anderson teaches religious studies courses at Westminster College and UNC. He is finishing his PhD at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in biblical studies with a dissertation on Matthew's form of Mark. His research interests are the history of the Bible and the rapidly changing role of religion in the 21st century. He has appeared on Mormon Stories, Mormon Matters, and Mormon Expression, which happens to be this man's podcast, and just launched his own podcast, Mormon Stories Sunday School. He lives in Salt Lake with his wife, Katrina, and 5 children, and I would highly recommend his podcast. It's very, very popular. And I feel like I'm blocking you.
This isn't the first time.
It's true. This is John Larson. He is the executive director of the Whitefields Education Foundation and the host of the Mormon Expression podcast. John is a 7th generation member of the LDS Church with Utah roots. He served a mission in San Diego, California among the Laotian refugees and has a lifelong interest in Mormon studies, particularly Mormon history, culture, and doctrine. John graduated from BYU with a BA in linguistics and from Weber State University with an MBA. John took the journey out of Mormonism about 10 years ago. So before we get into the debate, I've been entrusted with the trusty coin toss to see who is going to be to go first. And I just have to give you a disclaimer, I've never tossed a coin like in front of people before. So I hope I do it right, and I hope I don't like skew like the results of the debate with this. So I'm gonna ask you, do I ask you to choose this one?
I'm not a big sports guy.
How does this, like, would you choose a side, Jared Anderson? Would you choose heads or tails?
Tails. I'll take heads.
All right. Wish me luck. The big moment. Tails. So, John Larson, we'll start with you.
Well, you get to choose.
Oh, you get to he gets to choose.
I think I'll go first. You ready?
First of all, let me say that I hate the way this question's been written. The question we're debating is, does religion have value? And unfortunately, whenever I get into a debate about religion, it always gets into epistemology. So I'm going to try to head that off really early. Let's start by defining our terms. When we talk religion, we can't be just talking about what people believe, because then we get into universalisms. And if we say belief is good, fine. What does that mean? That's not religion. It's not religion to have an individual belief. So we don't want to cordon this off and say anything that anybody believes can have value, because we've just done a tautological backing into a corner, and we're not going to get anywhere. We also have to make sure that we're not talking about science, and I'm going to define science as that which uses logic, reason, or mathematics to arrive at conclusions. And if my worthy opponent wants to try to discuss whether or not science is a religion, we'll be happy to go there. But I'm going to discount that and say that which has been empirically proven through the scientific method is not religion and outside the scope of what we're discussing here. So we're not talking about individual ethics. And also, I would like to say we're not talking about shared human values. If we find something that's universal, that all people believe, that is programmed into our DNA, I would say we can't define that as religion either, because that is something that exists outside of whatever religious constructions we have. We must talk about something that is cohesive and definable, and not just definable as in a group. We can't say that everybody who thinks Star Trek is interesting is a religion. There needs to be something else, and that something else seems to be an exercise of power. And we'll get into that more as we talk over the next hour. I also think, as we're talking about religion, that we can't define religion too broadly. We must define it specifically as a specific pattern of belief or a specific pattern of thought. We also have to talk about what it means to be valuable. The problem with value is almost everything has value to somebody. If I break into your house and steal your jewels, that's a valuable exercise to me. So we can't just say something is of value, because once again, we're talking about everything. Everything has value to somebody, almost universally. We also have to be careful about utilitarianism here, because if we start saying, well, something is valuable if it provides the most value for the greatest number of people, we have the paradox of slavery, which is a slave-based system like the one the Romans exercised can be very valuable to even the majority of the population. We could all vote here that one of you give us each a dollar. And on the whole, that would be a great exercise. We would, most of us, 99% of us would come out richer, right? But on the backs of the one person. And that would be valuable to 99% of us. So we have to throw that definition out right away. We can't say we're looking at a value for even the majority. We have to look at things that have a value that transcends those two systems. And this is where religion becomes difficult. We also can flirt around with the idea of hedonism here. If something feels good or something tickles our sensations, well, that can have value too. So I want to return to this idea as we talk for the next hour of comparing this to, say, an opium den, and say, well, is religion any different than something that gives us pleasure and something that gives us a temporary fix? A lie that is used in the service of good is still a lie, and I would say it's a damned lie. It's even worse than most lies that we have. Because a lie that's used in the service of good promotes what we perceive as good in that moment above truth, above what we can verify through those elements I mentioned before, through logic, through reason, through empirical viewing. And so if we justify something as saying, we're going to twist the truth, we're going to tell a lie to make sure people behave themselves, we're putting a temporary value on behavior over these intrinsic values of discovery that we've put, that we've seen advance society. And I also want to say, as we start to defining religion, we need to make sure that we're clear about defining it as separate from the other systems out there. We have developed over the millennia systems of civic control, of what's illegal, and the tort system of being able to sue somebody if they take your property. We have government and we have laws, and these systems exist since the Enlightenment outside of religious purview, and they've been functioning very well for us. So when we take these things together, we say religion cannot be science, because science is based on empiricism and logic. Religion cannot be an individualistic ethic, because all people have these ethics, and if we define religion as that, we're not talking about anything other than an internal moral compass. And if we take it and separate it out from the civic systems that we have to regulate behavior, what exactly are we left with? Well, I'm fascinated by the First Amendment protection of religious rights, because the amendments protect all sorts of rights. They protect the right to free speech. They protect the right to assembly. They protect the right to the press. They protect most of the things that we would associate with being able to communicate and to form communities and do great things. But this right to religion seems to be a strange one, because it seems to be the only right that's a right in reversal. The right to free practice of religion in the United States seems to be the right to freely discriminate. Because we can say, you can't discriminate based on religion or sex or race or whatever else, unless you're a religion. Then we're going to give you an exception. And that's where religion becomes dangerous. Because once we move away from individual ethics and we start forming these societies and these organizations around a combined set of values, it's not just a mutual shared belief, but a religion is something that goes one step beyond and starts to define that this is what you must believe to be part of us, and this is how you must behave if you're part of us. And once we start doing that, we start dictating individual codes of behavior. And if people of their own free will and choice had values that lined up perfectly, we would just call that a community. We wouldn't call it a religion. We wouldn't need any glue to stick those people together. The only reason we need the glue is if people are not doing that, if people do not actually believe these things. And the more institutional they get, it's based on the fact that the adherents don't actually believe everything that's being told. So we have to start wrapping structure around it. We have to start bullying and pushing people into behaving or believing something in the name of orthodoxy. And that's where religion is differentiated between those other things that I've talked about. There's one more that we should probably mention that will come up, and that's culture. As human beings, we transmit our values by song and speech and whatever else. And that is, I would say, a universal that transcends religion. That religion is a subset of culture. And there are those who will tell us that many of the great works, that many of the great ideas and advancements of society have come to us from religion. They would point to Michelangelo's paintings. But it's a sleight of hand. Because what religion is doing is it's co-opting what already exists inside of us, what we're already able to accomplish, because they were writing the checks to Michelangelo. It wasn't the church that trained him to paint or taught him what beauty is. And this pattern has been replicated over and over and over again. The reason Mormons sing Stephen Foster songs in their hymn book is because Stephen Foster was a great musician. And they co-opted it, and they made it their own. And what religion tends to do is it takes things from us, it wraps them back up, and it sells them back to us. And the question we have is, do we really need that intermediary to take them and sell them back? Because the problem is, they then gain power. And power is something that can be, and always has been, corrupted to accomplish negative things. Humans have a basic instinct not to kill. Humans have a basic instinct not to take things from other people. Humans have a basic instinct to cooperate. And when we see on large scale, not the individual abhorrent, but we see on large scale when this is subverted by humanity, it is always for these large organizations like religion or nationalism. And what they tend to do then is tell people, don't steal, don't kill, unless you're killing in the name of God, unless you're killing in the name of the church. And that's why religion becomes dangerous, because it becomes a way to subvert the natural instinct that human beings have to behave. The last thing I want to say in the last few seconds is the way religion does this is in the most insidious way. Religion takes over the things that are most valuable to us, life and death, and it takes ownership of those. And once we realize that these things, life and death, are intrinsic, and they belong to all of us collectively, just like the ethics, just like our culture, just like our community does, then we'll realize that what religion is doing is a net negative for humanity.
Mr. Anderson?
Thank you very much. My own intro will respond to most of your points, so I will address only those points that are not in my intro. I think we need to distinguish, you said religion is not a science. I hope that we will talk a bit about the fact that even though religion is itself not a science, science can provide insight into religion. We can have the scientific study of religion, specifically the social sciences, that there are many ways that we can understand human nature, of which religion is a subcategory. I think that that was an oversimplification of utilitarianism. I think that a tempered or nuanced utilitarianism is productive when it comes to discussing value, and that is what I will be proposing. Once again, hedonism is, we are clusters, insert expletive, of competing desires, competing values, competing, you know, what feels good. You know, the Greek philosophers talked about higher goods, lower goods, higher pleasures, lesser pleasures. You talked about, you know, that makes me think of credo consolans, you know, I believe, because it makes me feel comfortable. Marx would be proud of your opium reference. Truth is very squirrely, because there is not only the investigation of external realities, there is the investigation of internal realities. And again, I'll talk about that. That is social science, that is the study of human behavior, and we can achieve predictable results through social sciences. The protection of religious rights, I think, is an unfortunate reality. I concede that point. I think it's very unfortunate, for example, that there is the Michigan exception to the bullying law that ironically was put into law because of the gay student who killed himself, and they're like, oh, unless you're religious and you're an asshole because you're religious, then go ahead. I'm glad that you have that last sentence, otherwise I wouldn't have known what your position is regarding the value of religion, so I'm glad that was clearly stated at the end. I think that is an invalid distinction of community. Community is part of a complex system, so you can't just simply distinguish religion from community. I would say what people do or don't actually believe with the response that socialization is inevitable. We have to teach something as normal, although you and I would agree, I'm sure, about the need to treat ability, or we need to teach the ability to think and get at principles, as Joseph Smith once said. Religion is a subset of culture. I agree. My strongest disagreement with you is your arguments about innateness. I would disagree that morality is innate, that structure is innate, that we already have within ourselves artistry. And in fact, I would describe religion as an operating system that structures all of these aspects of us. And I will go into the relationship between evolution and religion, so we will have some common ground to discuss. Our basic instinct is not to kill. Again, that's overly simplistic. We do have aversion to killing, but at our core, we are prepared to defend our in-group and kill our out-group. The fact that you added in nationalism that functions similarly as religion weakened your argument, because we need to keep clear about which aspect is doing what. And religion co-opts life and death. I would agree, but once again, the way I feel like that is a non-issue, since the way in which it co-opts life and death can be either beneficial or harmful or both. So should I go into my opening? First, I want to thank Sunstone, Blake for moderating, the organizers, and John for suggesting, nay, insisting on this debate. I'm grateful for the opportunity to debate such a fascinating, important, and comparatively easy topic. We could be debating the truth of religion. I would have won that one, too. But that debate would require far squishier and nebulous arguments. So on to the proposition that religion is valuable. I could demonstrate that religion has a modicum of value and pronounce myself minimal victor, but I'm going to set the stakes higher than that. I define value as well as religion in a moment, but the value possibilities are as follows. One, religion has unique value. Two, religion has partial or conditional value, good for children or those who think like children, for example. Or three, religion has no unique value and we just need to get the hell over it. I will debate the position that not only does religion have value, but that religion has unique value. No one system does, for good and ill, all that religion does. It is a cultural technology that yields unique benefits due to how it engages with us individually, relating to psychology, neurology, and physiology, and collectively, relating to, for example, to social structures, ideology, and worldviews. As we prepare to debate the value of religion, we must keep a number of elements distinct, which John will have a chance to correct in the future discussion. First, we must distinguish between benefits and harm due, one, to religious denominations, two, to religion in general, and three, human nature. For example, in a Mormon context, shunning family because of the temple or underwear wearing habits would fall into category one. Misdirected investment toward the afterlife or denial of individual responsibility due to religious beliefs would fit largely into category two. And the tendency to tribalism and violence would fall into category three. I will work to focus my remarks on category one, denominational distinctiveness, and two, religion as a cultural system, while keeping in mind their relationship to three, human nature. So for example, even though religion is disempowering, that is one of my primary critiques of it, we humans like being disempowered. We are terrified of accepting responsibility for our own lives, so that would overlap with human nature. Value is subjective, as John rightly pointed out, but must be defensible to others of differing investments, perspectives, and preferences. I propose as a measure of value the ability to marshal evidence and arguments that something deserves to exist. If we measure value according to the investment and sacrifice people are willing to pay, religion likely tops the list. Approached only by nationalism, family, and self-interest as runners-up, and people sacrifice all of these for the sake of religion. Can you think of any cultural structure or ideology that motivates more powerfully and universally than religion? One could easily argue that humans value religion far more than it deserves, but in that admission itself, that would demonstrate the value to an uncontestable degree. As I said, in this debate, I will argue that religion holds unique value unmatched by any one cultural system or even a combination of several cultural elements, with unmatched measured by its level of engagement with human nature yielding beneficial outcomes. I am measuring benefit by those elements that facilitate the sustainable well-being of conscious life on Earth. That's my softened, nuanced utilitarianism, and the planet itself. So again, those elements that facilitate the sustainable well-being of conscious life on Earth and the planet itself. So for example, to your utilitarianism point, there would not be a net benefit because the person who gave $100 would suffer as much as the 100 people who gained one. So again, I hope that we all agree that sustainable well-being of conscious life on Earth is a good thing. And unfortunately, it is a goal whose outcome remains very much in question. Now to religion. I define religion, John got to defining religion, as a cultural system of interconnected beliefs and rituals in the context of community in reference to transcendent reality. Once again, that is a cultural system of interconnected beliefs and rituals in the context of community in reference to transcendent reality. So it is not the beliefs in and of themselves, it is not the actions in and of themselves that make a religion, it is the interconnection between the two. What is the difference between putting on a sundress, putting on a formal gown, when it's not cross-dressing, I'm talking to women, or putting on a wedding dress? It is not the action, it is not the behavior, it is the meaning connected to the behavior that makes it powerful. As John said, it is true that religion, there cannot be, debatably, a religion of one person. Usually we use the word spirituality or idiosyncrasy or mental illness for those ideas. So yes, transcendent reality must be in there to distinguish religion from what I call near religions, which once again, John alluded to these near religions, which are things like government, the military, sports, or music culture. I would say North Korea is a cult-level government, and boot camp is a cult-level rite of passage in a non-religious context. But these are near religions. I have read articles on the Super Bowl as a religious festival, and there are pilgrimages related to music culture. Religion usually contains, well, always contains history, usually contains beliefs relating to cosmology or origins, beliefs relating to behavioral requirements, ritual, myth, often but not always preserved in scripture, and hierarchy and social organization. A religion needs all of these elements to be a religion. A core function of religion is to construct a sense of control and manage disappointment when those attempts to control fail. The purpose of religion, from an insider's perspective, is to align one's life with the will of unseen supernatural beings, to align one's life with the supernatural realm. So then you can distinguish one religion from another by examining the nature of those spiritual beings, those transcendent beings, whether they be ancestors, spirits, gods and goddesses, and so forth, and the way in which the religion sets themselves, the religious set themselves right with the spiritual realm as they perceive it. We must also, very importantly, so not only are we distinguishing problems of denominations, problems of human nature, problems of religion in general, and problems of human nature, we must also distinguish religion as it has been, religion as it is now, and religion as it could be, as well as the diversity of lived religion as experienced by its adherents. And it is upon all of those factors that we must value the we must examine and debate the relative value of religion.
Mr. Larson, 4 minutes.
All right. I agree with much of what Jared has said when we're talking about religion as a subsystem of culture. And also, I really liked how Jared said that religion has unique value in its motivation that it's more powerful, that it motivates to power. It has unique value because it's particularly powerful as a cultural entity for human beings. This I absolutely agree with. When we say it's a subset of culture, one must rightly ask the question, well, what makes it unique from culture? Because none of us would deny the value of culture or say it doesn't exist. We're saying there's this little subsystem. And the language that Jared uses, he uses the word transcendent reality. The problem with transcendent reality is it doesn't exist. When we talk about religions, what really makes them unique from other cultural systems, and don't get me wrong, religion is pretty well universal. It's out there all over. But what makes it unique as a cultural system is its reliance on both the supernatural and the metaphysical. The problem with the supernatural and the metaphysical is, by definition, they don't exist in our realm of scientific inquiry. They can't be verified. They can't be validated. And once those can't be validated, we have to rely solely on the word or the authority of the religion as a truth measure. And that's the seedbed of religion's power, because religion exists outside that which can be confirmed. There's no way for us to go outside the religious system and say, yes, that's true or not. Or if such a system exists, like using another religion or using science and reasoning, then the religion is dismantled by definition. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there. It wouldn't be a metaphysical system. It would just be subsumed into our scientific system. Or one religion would dominate the other. This is why they're all in conflict, because they have to rely on these power structures that don't exist. And once they don't exist as reality out there that can be verified, they can be abused. And that is the seedbed of power. Jared was exactly right when he said that religion is good for children or people who think like children. I agree 100%. The problem, the net effect, is though, it keeps people as children. It is true that there are many people, and I have met plenty of them in my life, and so have you, who need religion. We're all in agreement on that point. But the problem is it keeps people in this infantile state. And it's good when it works. It's good when the stories we're telling are about Santa Claus and the fairy and the tooth fairy, who are going to get a net good. But once the system, once the structure is in place to abandon reason, to abandon science, and vest in authority, those systems can and always are abused. And they're abused and manipulated because the systems have kept this juvenile state of adherence to this illogical system. And that system itself is the problem. So even if you could show me a perfect religion, one that uses myth and culture and metaphysics and whatever boogeyman stories to keep people fully in line, the system is still inherently inferior to a system based on reason or empiricism because it has as its seed the potential for corruption because the corruption is baked into the very foundation. So I think that we're mostly in agreement. Thanks.
All right, Mr. Larson, you mentioned that these power structures don't exist. This would lead us into why do we have religion?
The metaphysical power structures.
Oh, the transcendent.
Yes, the transcendent.
Okay. How and why, where did they come from? Where did they originate?
The supernatural beliefs.
Minutes.
The supernatural beliefs, you're saying? I think they exist for the same reason. They exist ultimately. I would hypothesize that they evolved because they have a net good, right? If I tell children that outside the fire ring, the boogeyman is there, then the children know not to wander out into the darkness where there are actual holes and rocks and wolves. So I can tell them a story and manipulate their human instinct of fear in order to arrive at a certain behavior. That these things have utility or that they have individual value is great. One of the reasons people hypothesize that Christianity spread so quickly among the slave class of the Romans was because it gave them something to look forward to in an otherwise dismal, short life. That beautiful heaven awaited. We can endure what's happening here on earth. We don't need to work to change it. And we don't need to overthrow our fearful masters because in the end we get 72 virgins. And who doesn't want that? This guy. So it exists as something that has value, but is that value intrinsic? I would use the word rather than transcendent because it is something that can be manipulated.
Mr. Anderson, same question.
Okay, let's talk about religion in the past. Where has religion gotten us? And how did it begin anyway? I have more than speculations and theories. As a starting point, I appeal to evolutionary theory applied to both biology and culture and agree with those who propose, and as John admitted, that religion would not be a cultural value or a cultural universal if it did not have a value, have value and adaptive qualities. I will first discuss a few aspects of the origins and evolution of religion and then say a few words about the relative benefits and costs of religion in the past. I only need a few more minutes. We will. We cannot know for sure when religion began, but one important milestone occurred about 300,000 years ago. Rituals surrounding burials, such as marking bones and especially burying objects with the dead. A better way to describe the origins of religion is to say it had no clear beginning. God put it there. No, I'm kidding. But rather piggybacked onto human features that go back millions of years. In brief, religious elements first engaged biological features and then co-evolved with human cultural evolution. As Daniel Dennett has noted, wild features of religion's precursors, in a word, superstition, including highly damaging beliefs and practices such as condemning witches or sacrificing children, developed into domesticated forms that still required investment, some of it horrific, and remained counterintuitive, but also yielded powerful benefits, as I will discuss momentarily. Bipedalism and brain development, key features that make humans distinct, developed about 4 million years ago. Pelvis to cranium ratio required that babies be born early and remain dependent far longer, which increased our interdependence on each other as humans. Babies relied on their mothers, and mothers relied on other humans to help bear the burden of care, which led to increased attachment, as well as relating to other interesting features such as the human relative hairlessness. Not enough for some, I guess. Our brains continue to develop in part because of a diet of cooked meat, but also because of the need to remember our relative status and social relationship within our tribes, up to about 150 people. The increased social complexity bound us inextricably to our groups. Ostracism, social death, would also equal physical death for most of human history. As Chelsea Shields Strayer has said, belonging has proved exponentially more valuable than logical coherence. Belonging has proved exponentially more valuable than logical coherence. And I'm relying largely on her gripping research for this in other sections. Social survival required trade-offs, and this is where religion comes into the picture. Danger signals, costly signaling theory, hyper-agency detection devices, and the theory of mind and mirror neurons provide examples of the ways that religion plugged into our biological evolution and contributed to our social and therefore physical survival. Our systems warning us against physical danger crossed over to apply to social danger. Suddenly, if people don't like us or approve of us, if we feel like an outsider, our physiology responds as if a lion is chasing us and we are in physical danger. This leads to intellectual, emotional, social, and cultural stress. We are advanced enough to make ourselves sick. Costly signaling theory will prove important to discussion of the value of religion. The basic idea is that counterintuitively, and this is mind-blowing, Richard Sosis has done research on this, it is the ridiculous or even harmful elements of ritual that best encourage trust and cooperation among members of a group. Once again, I say trust and cooperation are more valuable than logical coherence that many, including my beloved friend here, fetishize. We can't necessarily trust someone, but we have more reason to believe them to be reliable if they engage in the same costly rituals as we do. And this is why Mormons check each other's underwear, by the way. There's a problem with MLMs, but, you know. Hyper-agency detection device, our need to predict how others will act toward us and lead us to attribute meaning and agency, including attributing needs and desires of unseen agents. So the basic idea is that because of our need to predict what any other person is thinking and intending as they come toward us, is this an ally, is this an enemy, does that girl want me, does that guy want me, we need to be able to predict that, and our hyper-evolved ability to predict, to create versions of people in our heads, basically, also created God. And our ability to empathize with others and our acute sensitivity to the social expectations of our groups that were so important led us to being sensitive to the needs of supernatural beings. So I'm going to conclude with one paragraph. For our second point, weighing the past benefits of religion, we are severely hindered by our lack of a control for comparison. We have no access to a contrafactual past where religion didn't exist or been the norm. How do we measure value anyway? Is progress always a good thing? And in conclusion, I propose that we measure benefit by looking at both stability and innovation. These elements at productive tension have brought us to where we are. Not that that's a great place, but it's where we are. My central argument is that innovation has benefited from a broader environment of stability, and that religion has proved critical to that stability. Yes, religion has often resisted innovation at first, and for a long time, but religion has also showed an ability to incorporate these innovations if slowly. The conservatism of religion contributes to a stabilizing power, and thus we move forward in fits and starts of competing needs and values.
To follow up, Mr. Larson, of religion and innovation, and that question of the integration of the two that he proposed there at the end.
The integration of which two?
Of religion as a mechanism of innovation.
Well, it's more stability. It's more that religion is the broader stability from which the innovation can happen. For example, so there are Hindu and Greek philosophers that didn't believe in religion, but they wouldn't have the luxury. It's kind of like there couldn't be academics if there weren't farmers. There wouldn't be the luxury.
luxury of being an atheist philosopher if there were not the wider stability of society that religion largely contributes to.
So that as a base versus your proposal that religion came about to keep people from jumping out of the ring and encountering the boogeyman.
Well, let's do that. Let's take our religions and pile up all their innovations here and here and here, and then pile up the innovations of the other systems we have of logic and reason. Religion has been on like a 3,000 year retreat from science and losing every battle at every corner. The religion has given us relative stability, but at what cost? I think that Jared rightly pointed out that religion's value is in terms of belonging, and this belonging creates stability. But one might ask, if religion's value is giving us a sense of belonging, which creates stability and innovation and whatever else, why don't we do something simple? Just say, you're all humans, you all belong, done. Obviously, that doesn't work. So belonging entails something else. It doesn't entail just having an in-group, it entails having an out-group. And you want the stability of religion, you have to have an enemy. And the enemy is the other. And it's going to be somebody else who doesn't look the same, who doesn't talk the same, who doesn't worship the same gods. As Jared pointed out, there's these mechanisms, be they underwear or incense burning or whatever, that mark you as a friend and not an enemy. But they're strong markers in our evolution. And let's be clear, evolution is a terrible mistress. And evolution has no master other than what happens. And evolution has led to some very, in our human perspective, some very awful things. And we can't value it just because it evolved. So evolution gave us the ability, the cultural cohesion and the ability to create religion. But one can't declare victory just because it's a byproduct of our evolution. One must look and say, as humans now, we can see better value than just this evolutionary survival and passing your genes on to the next generation. And unfortunately, that structure that Jared refers to, that gives us a sense of belonging, will always create an enemy, an other, and somebody else to be hated.
Okay, 4 minutes on how does religion contribute to and compromise individual well-being?
Excellent. When we talk about collective well-being, we'll talk about in-group, out-group. As a little teaser, it is our in-group who keeps us alive. And if it is at the cost of an out-group, so be it. And also, as I have said, tribalism and violence are human problems, not specifically religious problems. Okay, what does religion do for the individual? And I'll be nuancing these. Psychologists who study well-being have identified 5 features that all humans seek of their own volition across cultures. I will take each element of this acronym, PERMA, and discuss briefly how religion contributes to and at times detracts from individual well-being. One is positive emotion. This is what we usually think of as happiness. We like it when we feel pleasant emotions. The ritual and familiarity of religion can bring happiness. Religion eases social pain through clear expectations, roles, and a sense of belonging. For a lot of people, it prevents us from being quivering piles of epistemic angst. Religion manages social emotions through scripts and rituals for conflict resolution, forgiveness, meaning. On the other hand, guilt and shame can be both positive and negative, and failure to fit into scripts can lead to depression and even suicide. So for most, religion can be net benefit on that, but we need to keep in mind the costs. Engagement, the E. We are happy when we lose ourselves in difficult tasks at which we excel. Religion provides both opportunity and training at specific tasks. We can become specialists within the specific bounds of religious practice. Think of a Talmud scholar. Who the hell cares about the Talmud? Jews. Religious structure and these repetitive opportunities also contribute to well-being through the sense of flow. Relationships. Religion brings conditional benefit when it comes to relationships. If individuals are on the same page religiously, and this is something that John is acutely aware of and a lot of us are, it can powerfully contribute to well-being. Not only do individuals form alliances and even families among religious boundaries, and then it leads to divorce sometimes, But religion provides the precious sense of religious congregations all being one big family through what is called fictive kin groups. On the other hand, differences of religious belief and practice can cause tension and schisms among those precious relationships. Not that anyone here would know anything about that. In addition, we should not neglect, and this is a productive point of discussion, I think, between me and John, we should not neglect the imaginary social relationships religion provides, imagined communities. Devotees of rationality may scoff, but sometimes when every other relationship has failed, God as an attachment figure can save lives and provide hope and motivation to persevere. Gods and goddesses, spirits, ancestors, angels, scriptural characters, and the like can all replicate the positive feelings we have in our real relationships. In fact, at times they can have greater strength because they are idealized. Moroni was my best friend until I decided figured out he didn't exist. Think about the child with no positive role models who therefore latches onto the figure of God or Jesus and becomes a better person because of their conception of these figures. Meaning, religion interacts richly with all of the elements of individual well-being, and this is my main point that I'll really focus on, but meaning may constitute its trump card. As humans, we crave meaning and order, and because all meaning is constructed, no meaning proves more potent than myths shared by communities across hundreds or even thousands of years. The sense of being cosmically important and having a role to play and fitting into the drama of history with clear visions of past, present, and future, no individually constructed system of meaning can compete. In fact, the question, why are we here, constitutes my answer to Sam Harris's challenge. To wit, I would challenge anyone to think of a question upon which we once had a scientific answer, however inadequate, but for which the best answer is a religious one. Close Harris. I am not speaking of the question, how did we get here? Science spanks religion on that one. But why are we here? The answer, to perpetuate your DNA, somehow pales next to the rhetorically and emotionally powerful myths of religion. And because these myths lead to real life benefits, and this is once again a key point that we should discuss, myth can be considered reality one step removed. Let me repeat, myth is real because of its consequences and outcomes. And just to conclude really quick, religion also contributes to achievement, placebo effects, morality as a prosthetic, and in summary, it's possible to be well and thrive without religion, but near impossible to gain all the benefits of religion without literally believing in and actively engaging in religion.
So we're talking here about the individual's well-being. And individual well-being is great if the individual you're talking about is yourself. The hatred and prejudice noted against atheists in the United States is very well documented. And to hear religious folks say, look inside our circle and it's great, we're fucking happy, it's wonderful in here, come on in. You're okay as long as you want to come on in. But if you don't, then your well-being is sacrificed at the altar to their gods. Now, Jared went through a list of all these things that that religion provided individuals that gave them, you know, they were happiness and script and ritual and relationships, and I sat and ticked through my list. I have long since abandoned any sort of religion or any sort of metaphysical view, and I couldn't find anything on Jared's list that I do not enjoy on a daily basis. I have no need for any sort of supernatural, any sort of God, or any structure in any church telling me how to live to find meaning and purpose. Even Jared's well-reasoned argument about imagined relationships, that these relationships amongst individuals and communities are sort of a collective deception that we buy into and that thus creates the relationship. The same things can be constructed outside of religion. Non-religious people talk about folks like Carl Sagan and Sam Harris with the same reverence that the saints are worshipped. Now, I'm not proposing that that's a good thing, but there's no problem in substituting in others who serve this imaginary role. And if those are harmless, because I've never heard a secularist argue that Carl Sagan, you know, appeared to him on a piece of toast or told him to invade Poland, that hasn't happened yet. parenthetically, I want you to know I haven't mentioned the Nazis yet once. It's been almost an hour, and I have not mentioned the Nazis at all. So, thank you. So I see that these things have value, but I don't see this metaphysical religious system as a necessary component, although religious people will tell you that it is.
Okay, just kind of a follow-up there to Mr. Larson. Mr. Anderson suggests that we are happy to lose ourselves to religion. This comes in contrast to your opening statements of that religion takes from us and resells back out. I was just curious if you could give us two minutes on that.
I don't see the conflict there. I will acknowledge that religion gives a strong sense of identity and a strong sense of purpose and a strong sense of place. And what I would argue is that religion oftentimes does this through with the juvenilization that we talked about before. Religion will say, without religion, without Jesus Christ, you're a worm. You're a rapist. You're a murderer. And the only thing keeping you from doing that is your faith in these transcendent gods. And if without those, you would be a devil and devilish. When we observe people in the real world, that doesn't play out. Famously, we've done surveys on prison populations, and atheists are underrepresented in prison compared to their overall population, and many fundamentalist Christian groups are overrepresented. Well, a possible explanation might be an atheist looks and says, this is all I got, and I don't want to spend the rest of my existence in the pokey, so I'm going to behave myself.
Or they're rich and
white. I mean, that's a fair answer, too. Either of which transcend religious construction, right? So I don't see the conflict because I think that religion actually tells people they need religion. When they don't, it's a lie.
Can I say a few things so far?
Yeah, just a two-minute follow-up on that.
Yeah. As far as that we only care about our individual well-being, empathy disallows that. I mean, we certainly care about those close to us, and we have, in fact, it has been critical to human survival that we can put ourselves in the place of others, you know, and that we can imagine how someone else feels, even if it's against our own interest, and I'm really grateful for that. I would actually be interested in hearing your thoughts sometimes, John, about the fact that you were raised religious. I do not contest in any way your happiness currently. I think it is wonderful that you feel all of these aspects of fulfillment of PERMA. But again, the issue is I don't think that we can deny the fact that you and I were raised being taught that we were manly men, future gods who are cosmically important. And we can't know. We would need to look in the alternate reality of the never religious John and the never religious Jared to truly evaluate the degrees to which we would have these levels of individual well-being. I also, the white rich prison comment was a nod to it, but I would also gently remind you that you are highly privileged. And so it is this privilege that we need to remember. I mean, I agree that it is possible to achieve almost all the benefits of religion without religion, but only if you're incredibly privileged. It's like, I'll take a side of Upanishads after yoga and after I pick my children up from Hebrew school because I just think it's really great for them to learn Hebrew. I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of wealth and connections. You need to have your friend needs met. You need to have your relationship needs met. Another point that I'd like to hear your thoughts on at some point and respond to is you concede the point religion has valuable for some people. So it sounds more like you're in category two than category three, which I appreciate that. So that you would say religion is partially and conditionally valuable. I would have put you in the category that get the hell over religion. And I'm impressed. So if religion has partial or conditional value, how many people need religion? And what would be the alternative if they didn't have religion? For example, if we had no speed limits, like, does everyone need a speed limit? No, but should we get rid of them anyway?
Okay, leading into the next question, we'll start with you, Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Anderson.
Soon to be Dr. Anderson, if you prefer. how does religion contribute or compromise collective well-being?
Yeah, and I think this is one of the real money moments when it comes to religion and as far as what it's doing. We'll talk about religion and violence, religion and ethics. I mean, as soon as people think about the value of religion, these are the terms that are the hot button issues. You know, and this is when the Nazis come up.
All right.
So as I hope I have demonstrated, psychology can get a pretty good handle on individual well-being. Collective well-being, on the other hand, resists definition of an ideal, primarily because society, by its nature, is a compromise between individual needs and group needs, right? Individuals enter social contracts, and I would actually add that society itself is a collective illusion. It is, by its nature, a compromise between the needs of the individual and the needs of the group. Individuals enter social contracts and give up some of their freedoms, temper their own desires and preferences, and do things they otherwise might not do themselves as trade-offs for greater cooperation and safety within a group. I resist my urge to kill my neighbor and steal his wife. I mean, they didn't in the Bible, but... with the hope that I will receive the same respect. Because of this tension, there's no perfect society, merely one that functions with different degrees of success. And even that success falls on different points along individual versus continuum. In fact, it could be argued that the strongest societies are those that motivate individuals to sacrifice and work for the greater good of the group. World War II Japan would be an example of that, and it's very scary. I cannot emphasize strongly enough that humans have survived, thrived, and conquered the world with deeply problematic consequences as groups, not as individuals. We are hyper-social animals, and keys to understanding religion's value lies in understanding how religion facilitates group cooperation and cohesion. Religion encourages, so basically, the word is pro-sociality, and there's in-group pro-sociality and out-group pro-sociality. As I said before, I personally think that the fundamental question is, how on earth do you get people to do things they don't want to do? And the hyper-liberal would say, well, no one should ever do anything that they want to do, but then they need to have children. I mean, I actually think no one who doesn't want to should have children, and some who do. But the issue is, how do we motivate? And, again, as I said, for good and ill, religion motivates like nothing else. So I personally think that you can't achieve a high level of in-group cohesion without creating an out-group, and so be it. When it's ridiculous, Jonathan Haidt and others have talked about, as stupid as the assignment is, if it's like, we're counting pennies, you're the blue team, you're the green team, suddenly humans are like, that green team, they're counting their pennies wrong, they're also ugly. And in-group, out-group behavior is so deep. And what I said, not that can we do better, bring it on. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But is we need to take our evolution very seriously. And so let's talk a little bit about religion and morality, and then religion and violence, which is a subset of morality. Religion is shit at morality. It's ethics. So I'm going to distinguish ethics from morality. Morality, and I may get this wrong, but someone will correct me, morality is like whether you live well. Ethics is whether you think about how to act. So someone can have a really terrible morality, but if they justify it, it's ethics. It's just really bad ethics. Or ethics we don't agree with, or ethics we don't like. And in fact, ethicists are more likely to steal library books than ethics. Anyway, it's really interesting. But what religion does do is it legitimizes, confirms, intensifies taboos that do function. It provides rules. Monogamy is a very beneficial myth, for example. And if we agree on these myths that are culturally conditioned and transmitted, it provides a really good rule. It is a prosthetic morality, as Daniel Dennett had said. And I would agree that, sure, religion provides morality for the juvenile people, and very importantly, it does prevent some people from thinking through the ethics, like why the hell does God care so much about butt sex? So it's like, yes, you know, there are these issues. Let me talk a little bit about religion and violence. Here are the regimes that have killed the most people. Spoiler, none of these regimes was motivated exclusively or even primarily by religion. We have Mao Zedong, China, 49 to 78 million of its own people because of efforts to industrialize as part of the Cultural Revolution. Violence against perceived enemies of the state. Stalin, Joseph Stalin, Soviet, 23 million of his own people, attempted industrialization, correctional labor camps, deportation, starvation. Hitler, here he goes, but come on in context. 17 million deaths relating to concentration camps, civilians in World War II, raise the tally to 40 million, depending on how much you want to blame World War II on him. His murder of Jews was mixed up with ideas of racial purity, but even if you count the Jews as a fully religiously motivated, note that the number of Jews killed, about 6 million, is only about a third of the total kills. I mean, I'm not minimizing massive death. And also, I'd say death itself is not necessarily a bad thing. No one has thus come up with a viable alternative. But causes of death can indicate problem behavior, so that's what we're looking at. Leopold of Belgium, I've never even heard of him, but apparently he killed 15 million Congolese because of rubber and ivory. Hideki Tojo, 5 million deaths related to unprovoked wars as well as eugenics against mixed blood versus pure blood Japanese. In conclusion, religion facilitates stability through clear scripts and roles and stable hierarchies and encourages pro-sociality, especially among in-groups. It increases social support and motivates us to care for each other. And so religion has collective value. And once again, a lot of the damaging elements are human problems, not just religious problems.
And we're talking about collective. So Jared hypothesized this alternate universe where he and I were raised without religion.
We're best friends, too.
Oh, well, yeah. We don't have to hypothesize about this. This exists. I have two children who have been raised completely without religion. And it was a troublesome idea for me. I had the same concern that Jared had. I said, what will happen? I had this upbringing. I went to primary and whatnot. What will happen to the next generation that doesn't have that? So I soothed myself by saying, well, I've got religion in my back pocket. The second I need it in raising my children, I will revert to it. And so far, the score is religion 0, secular parenting 1. I have never once needed to resort to any sort of metaphysical, supernatural lie to my children to make them behave. My children never even believed once that Santa Claus was real, and it's not diminished one iota from their enjoyment of Christmas as a holiday. And the problem with, when we look at this collective valuation, collectively valuing religion for the group, is we talk about privilege, and you know, Jared sort of accused me of being a privileged white male, which I am a privileged white male, but I also live in an underclass in Utah where I am an ex-Mormon, and I've experienced the underprivilege from that. If we take the juxtaposition that Jared gave us, that we have individual rights versus the collective social rights, that a society is this balance between people who want to maximize their own benefit, their own pleasure, their own whatever value in society, and society itself, I would say, great, that's a wonderful system. But then we have a parasite that enters into the system, and that's religion. Because otherwise, we can say we are collectively Utahns, or we collectively Americans, or we're collectively citizens of this world. And we can balance that back and forth. We have the individual needs of Utah citizens versus the needs of us all as a collective, the Utahards. But once we put religion in that, we now have another group that, just like a parasite, is trying to form its own sense of value and its own sense of collective worth at the expense of the rest of the system. Jared acknowledged that there is us and them, and so what? So what if you're the them? And it should be clear by now that I am the them when it comes to religion. And when religious people tell me, this is great, I say, I'm on the outside of it. And why can't we focus on our system as citizens of Utah instead of these weird collective systems that give special individual rights and special individual privilege that a small group can create the privilege systems that Jared rightly criticizes, these systems of privilege that perpetuate. Because since religion is an other than the collective, it is always a system of special privilege. It has to be. Why else would you join it? If I had a religion that I didn't give you any sort of special benefit, you only gave things up, like you paid 10% of tithing to me, but I didn't promise you any heaven or any other benefit, no one would join the system. The system has to usurp and give greater value than the general collective socialization. So what I would argue is that these systems are a net negative for society because they're a subversion of the resources that would otherwise go into building our collective society. And that's their problem by nature.
Okay, I would first say we have the same hope, you know, of something better than religion. And I'll nuance that a little bit better. But you say, I also have two non-religious children, surprise. And they also never believed in Santa Claus. So you say we could consider ourselves, we are all Utahns, we are all humans, but we don't. Show me the greater group of these unified humans seeking to save the world. Is Utah united? Is Congress? Why do sports work the way they do? Also, one interesting point, well, final point that I'll make, is America is staggeringly non-violent religiously. I mean, we bitch and moan about you're feeling so oppressed because someone prays for you or something. But we're not killing each other as they are in other places. And Robert Putnam and David Campbell in the book American Grace have a very interesting theory that, and it is true that atheists are the least likely, as Stephen Colbert said, you know, I wouldn't trust an atheist as far as I could throw him at a Muslim. It is true that atheists are the outsiders in America, but again, David Campbell and Robert Putnam proposed that it is this collective assumption of theism, which is a pretty darn low bar. It's like, oh, well, we all believe in God, we can get along, it can all be okay, and that has tremendous value in America. We don't have the wars of religion. And that's very impressive for how believing, how religious we are, and how nonviolent we are in America. As far as religion goes, we're violent in other ways.
Okay. Mr. Anderson, we'll start with you on this question. It's a hybrid from the crowd and question five on the list. Mentioning that you have two non-religious children, and granting that religion was valuable historically, could we one day, maybe in this modern world that we have, abandon religion altogether and still have a great collective society?
That's the question, right? I mean, this is the money question. If not religion, what? And this is also a good version of number two, which is religion was good for the childhood of human society. It's gotten us to where we are. Let's take off our diapers, get rid of the shit, and just be good human grown-ups. Unfortunately, behavioral economics proves the lie to that. You know, we are predictably irrational, as Dan Ariely has shown. And this will be a good point of rapprochement. Here's my direct answer to the question. I think that you can gain almost all the benefits of religion without religion, but you need to be incredibly privileged. It's like inventing your own language. Inventing your own language, people do it, but it is so complicated, it's so difficult. And so I think even, so my non-religious children, I think that, and my older children are Mormon, we can have a really strong family ritual, but there is nothing like the sense of, I am connected to something that goes thousands of years back. If I'm a Muslim, if I pray, half of the world is praying with me. I mean, there's nothing quite like that. So yeah, we can do a lot of benefits. I want to speak, if I may, a couple minutes on religion in the modern world, because I fully admit that religion is not up to snuff when it comes to the needs of the modern world. But also, we need to acknowledge that we have secularized poorly, as Alain de Botton says with his great accent, and that people are miserable. There are studies that show there's a positive correlation of depression, mental illness, stress-related diseases, blood pressure, a lot of massive problems in the developed world. It's like, we're the ones with all the money. Why the hell are we so depressed? And one problem is because, as I said, the secularized society does not align with human evolution. It is not so easy to, you know, brush off 4 million years of evolution and say, I'm a secularist, I'm rational. There are very severe problems in the modern world. Individually, as I said, we are depressed. We are currently in the sixth great extinction event. So my central argument is that though religion proves inadequate to and even distracts from, this is a big area of agreement, from confronting the desperate needs of modern world, it provides benefit that helps us cope individually and as small groups. And importantly, we as human beings have not provided any evidence that without religion we will fix the problems of the world. You know, that's a huge problem. Let's talk a little bit about the problems of the world. We have environmental problems that have exceeded the point of no return. Reliance on fossil fuels, pollution, waste, irresponsible use of water, deforestation, unsustainable use of resources, social problems, wealth inequality. 7.2 billion people in the world, 890 million undernourished, 1.6 billion overweight. Like double overweight. It's $24 million is spent every day on pet food in America. 18 million would feed all the hungry. As in the provocative, if the world were a village of 100 people, book notes, 80 would be substandard housing, 16 unable to read or write, 50 malnourished, 1 dying of starvation, 33 without access to safe water, 39 access to improved sanitation, 48 would live on less than $2 a day, 20 would live on less than $1 a day. To conclude, we have unequal treatment of and representation of women, violence, abuse, sex trafficking, slavery, corporate power, abuses accelerate the path. To conclude, though religion has contributed to and failed to repair these problems that plague us, it is difficult to argue that religion has been the primary cause of any of them. And importantly, religion does provide coping mechanisms to withstand problems that seem overwhelming to any given individual. To allude to Karl Marx, we cannot effectively move beyond the illusory comforts of religion, the opium of the masses, until we remove the need for those religions. And I think despite the fact that virtually all religion denominations are outdated and prove inadequate to the challenges of the modern world, the cultural technology of religion can adapt to modernity, and such an updated form of religion could yet prove our salvation.
I find Jared's arguments here to be quite alarming, actually. Jared has said that you must be incredibly privileged to not have religion. And then he defines privilege a few minutes ago as being white and being male and being rich.
White male is subcategory of privilege. Privilege is greater than white male.
I don't buy the argument that those outside of our traditional definitions of privilege are unable to achieve their problems without a paternalistic religion that's dictated to them by the upper class. I don't think that's true. I don't think that religion might be the candy of the rich and the privileged, but I think it's a candy of manipulation. And those who are in charge have always been able to subvert the rules. I think it is short-sighted to say we need religion to solve these problems because religion has not solved these problems thus far. What I would say, I agree with Jared completely that you cannot blame poverty and other problems of the so-called third world on religion. But what we can lay the blame at is having these problems at their doorsteps for thousands of years and doing fucking nothing about them. That the religions have allowed these problems to prosper, allowed these problems to grow. Religions go into impoverished places. And rather than rebuild the streets and the sewers and the wells, they extract 10%. And this has been the problem, and has been the problem from the get-go. I say religion needs to move over. They had their chance. And they can't say to us now, well, now we're getting to this problem. Bear with us. We know we had the Crusades, and we know we had the Inquisition, but that was just our infancy. And now we're ready to kick ass. Bullshit. Move out of the way. You are unable to deal with these problems.
Instead of a follow-up, it looks like you're prepared to just direct answer.
again, I would I would edit that. Religion has not allowed these problems to exist. Humans have allowed these problems to exist. And so again, we need to, I do agree with an argument you didn't make a lot, but I'll give it to you, that the promise of the afterlife and the promise of all these rewards has diminished. Religions have become fat and corrupt. But again, wealth and corruption, I mean, Wall Street is not a religious institution. These are human problems. When you have power, when you have wealth, you protect it. And so again, it is the structures of power. Colonialism is not exactly a religious, you know, it's like, yes, religion had a little bit of the motivating power, you know, God glory, but humans do a fine job taking what they think they want. So again, to productively debate this, we need to distinguish human problems from religious problems, and I do not feel you have adequately done that. And as a segue to the final point, I would say, if religion moves over, what else? And we bring it on. One more point, for example, Scandinavian socialism and so forth, that's fantastic, and that's good. It's doing well so far.
Okay. I've progressed into moving into the final argument stages of this. We'll have to cut it down to 5 minutes apiece to allow for a few questions. So for 5 minutes closing, trying to incorporate, as he stated, what should the future of religion be? You've kind of alluded to this. Move over. But expound.
Well, that's the emptiness in which you can give an
argument. A while back, there was a study that came out that showed that Utah had an elevated rate of suicide. In comparison to other states, it was in the extreme. And an asshole apologist came on and, not thinking, said, well, maybe it's not the Mormons, maybe it's the everybody else. And the response, the great response is, well, then what living next to Mormons would make everybody want to kill themselves in such a rate to be so statistically significant that it tops the charts? And I think that's a great question about religion. If religion is such a solution to the problem and the problem still exists, well then what being outside the religion makes it so terrible? Why is it so bad to be the other? Jared is right. The problems that we've talked about are human problems. They are not religious problems. I will not blame slavery on religion. I will not blame colonialism or warfare or any of these other atrocities. You can find religious causes for this, you can find nationalistic causes, you can find causes of just plain old selfishness. These things are human problems. But I would argue that human problems need human solutions. We don't need to then bring in the supernatural. Because as Jared alludes, that in America today, we're not as violent as we were in the past. And so we have all this, and America's hyper-religious in comparison to the rest of the industrial world. But I would say the gun is cocked and loaded. That religion has proven in the past that it is a powder keg that can go off at any time. And when you hear the rhetoric behind very peaceful people, even here in Utah, underlying Mormonism, that although Mormons are great neighbors, and I love living amongst them, and I love being neighbors with them, and I love the brownies they give me when they want to save my soul, not nearly as much the brownies that my non-Mormon friends give me. What were we talking about again? So we construct solutions to human problems through humanity, through dealing with these things, and not through these institutions that might deal with them in the short run, but in the end subvert this for their own means. To me, religions can be good, but they're good in as much as they are human systems. And they can be evil in as much as they are human systems. But that evil, powered by this supernatural fuel, leaves the tanks rumbling on the border of Poland all the time. There you go. And we're always about to have that subversive action that can trickle through religion very quickly. Because religion has primed people, as we talked about, kept them in an infantile state, kept them believing in this supernatural that is almost always vested in a particular authority, and an authority figure that has no means of questioning or no means of suggesting that they had, there's no way to give a vote of no confidence for a prophet, seer, and revelator. And that system has in its seedbed the power of corruption. Religion is a human institution. And this is something that every humanist and atheist needs to understand. And when I look at religion, I own it as much as I own being all of humanity. I do not see the bifurcation. I do not see the religious world versus the secular world, although religious people view the world that way, because I don't believe there are any gods or masters. So all of these systems were a product of humanity. The fact that you can argue that Pol Pot was not religious and Alexander was, is completely irrelevant. They're both human beings. They were both violent. They were both invaders. So that distinction becomes false. And once we eliminate that distinction, then I think we can move forward and start dealing with human problems in a human way.
I'm also a religious humanist, so, we're both humanists. I'm a religious humanist, so there's our distinction. Today we face the collision of unprecedented destructive and redemptive technology on one hand, and humanity and earth-endangering challenges on the other. It is obvious that Iron Age-rooted religious denominations prove insufficient to these challenges, as I've said, but we certainly can't rely on our far older prehistoric evolutionary dispositions either, which is what you seem to want to do. Let us all be human. We'll do really good things, like, you know, hoard billions of dollars. Humans evolve biologically, culturally, and technologically. Our technology does not teach us what to do with our power, and we haven't the time to wait to evolve into better beings, if such a thing were even a reliable possibility. We must turn to cultural evolution to bridge the gap between our primitive biology and space age technology. And as we seek to shape cultural evolution, we must take seriously the fact that nothing else engages our whole evolutionary brains as religion does. A cultural system that does all that religion does would be religion. And that is my hope, actually, is that there are better religions more aligned. I'm actually going to dedicate my life to this. Thus, I conclude that even religion as it is now, flawed and archaic, engages with our human nature in ways unmatched by any other cultural institution, and thus bears not only value, but unique value. Even more important and exciting, however, the cultural technology of religion. What I mean by cultural technology is religion as an operating system that engages our passions and motivations and makes us feel belonging and intense, like a good documentary, but a good documentary only makes you feel like that for a minute, and then you think about food or something else. It's persistent. Religion has been more persistent than anything else. If this cultural technology of religion is properly harnessed, it has the potential to motivate us to make changes that will facilitate the survival of human civilization itself, and possibly even extend the sustainable well-being of life on Earth. And that potential and promise carries undeniable value.
We'll start with a question from the audience. They specifically laid them for you and him, not for a both. So this is for you, Mr. Larson. As a materialist, you must admit that your ethical impulses are either evolutionary adaptations or historical coincidences. How can you have a theory of value that lets you say religion does not have value rather than John Larson does not prefer religion?
Well, the question begs the definition of value, because my actions might have value to me, and then they might be in disagreement with the questioner. I actually believe that there are some core values that are evident in our DNA, core values of compassion and the willingness to share, and the aversion to suffering, both in us and those around us, even in animals. That these are universal human elements. But don't get me wrong, we have other elements that were selfish. Watch a three-year-old. If you ask a three-year-old for what they're eating, they'll share it with you right away. But they probably stole it because they have those dichotomies. And I think we can look and see what those values are in humanity. And then we can go from there to build better systems. And these systems have sometimes been built well through religion. But we don't have to rely on the metaphysics. We don't have to rely on the structures that allow for the corruption at the top.
Okay. Mr. Anderson, you mentioned that you asked or proposed what system works better than religion in providing stable, a stable, unified community. They would propose and would like your comment on that a money or market-based pursuit of individual self-interest produces more voluntary cooperation and innovation among a more stable, diverse demographic.
I know, right? That's why we have no wealth inequality. I love it.
That was quicker than I anticipated. Okay, so these both are for you. If you could each just take 1 minute answering. This one asks to put yourself in a juxtaposition of, for you, John, what is the most compelling reason to maintain religious affiliation as to a rational adult?
The most compelling reason to maintain religion?
Yes.
To control the masses. The same reason we build prisons. But I think there comes a point in human evolution, our social evolution, we need to move beyond those systems, when we need to say prisons work by eliminating the malcontents and problematic people from society, but they don't solve the fundamental problem. Religions work by keeping people from, you know, spreading syphilis, but they don't solve the fundamental human problem. And I think we have to... You're right, they don't. I retract. He's right. Who are we kidding? It didn't work. No. No, so it works as it religion, to use the extended metaphor that we've been talking about, religion keeps people in a juvenile state. It keeps people perpetually in the fifth grade. And that's its benefit, because fifth graders aren't very dangerous, and they're easy to manipulate, and they're easy to extract labor and other things from. But I think we need to transcend those systems.
And for you, Mr. Anderson, what is the most compelling reason to abandon religion altogether?
Right. I mean, these are false polarities. But I would say the most compelling reason to, going with the question, the most compelling reason to move beyond religion would be to embrace a full accountability for your own life and your ability to choose. I think this is... And this is one thing where it is kind of incompatible with religion, where if you fully own your ability to make your own decisions, to think these through, you've broken your religion. You know, again, I think a lot of things need to be in place to do that well, but I think the most compelling reason is to live your own life, and hopefully you have the resources to live your life well, but that's what I would say. I myself have transcended my Mormonism. I'm very grateful, you know, to have done so. So once again, to fully own your ethics, your decisions, your choices, and that requires leaving religion behind to a degree.
Okay, last question. So just a minute apiece, so Lindsay can be happy with us for keeping the trains on time. For you, Mr. Larson, if religion doesn't have unique value, how can it, quote, parasite national identity, etc., as the basis of an in-group? Doesn't its ability to do this imply its strength or value?
Oh, yeah, well, I actually agree that religion has a lot of value for the insiders, but especially for the insiders at the top. Animal Farm benefited the pigs, right? And you can't argue that it doesn't. And so religion gives benefit to the insiders and special benefit to the ones who run the system.
And if you have a follow-up.
Yeah, really, so again, this we've been kind of talking about this theme. We are all insiders and outsiders simultaneously, you know, but it is our insiders, it is our people who will save us. Jonathan Haidt made a really provocative point that it is more important to have one person who will do anything for you than to live in a nice society. You know, it's more important to have one person who will wake up at 2 a.m. and drive somewhere and change your tire and stuff than to live somewhere nice. And again, it's human to manipulate and exploit, and so far. Again, I'm hopeful that what we can do is use everything good that religion does and take it very seriously in order to move beyond the archaic forms of religion we now have.